You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we're in Nîmes.
Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And a very youthful-looking Daniel Freeb.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel's had a shave for the podcast. 2 weeks into the tour, you've had your first shave. Well done, Daniel.
Making a bid for the white jersey.
No cuts or nicks.
Four razors that required. Four throwaway razors.
Really?
Yeah.
If you want to borrow some moisturiser, have a word with me later. Anyway, Lionel, where are we?
We're outside, we're just across the road from the football stadium, Nîmes Olympique's football stadium. They were in the French Ligue 1. They're not at the moment, they're in the second division. And I think this is the home of Nîmes...
Ligue 1?
Huh? Yeah, the first division, that Ligue 1. Ligue 1. but we... Our press room has been, I think, the home of Nîmes basketball team. Basketball very big in France.
And I imagine it'll probably be the press room for the Vuelta a España, which is starting here next year in Nîmes.
Correct. Well, it feels like we're far away from the mountains. We've sort of slept halfway across France on our way to the Pyrenees. We were in the Alps yesterday and we're en route to the Pyrenees via a rest day in Carcassonne. I think Daniel's heading to Carcassonne tonight, so we better keep this podcast pretty sharp and brief.
And staccato.
And staccato, yep. I'm trying a new style.
This podcast, yes.
I'm trying a new style.
Are we going to wrap it? Is that what we're going to do? We're going to wrap the podcast.
We're heading towards a wrap very soon. So today's stage 15, won by Jack Bauer. Oh, no, sorry. Won by Alexander Kristoff, his second stage win at this tour. Daniel, I think you made the point on Twitter that he is a bit of a diesel, and certainly Marcel Kittel, who was unbeatable at the start of the tour, nowhere to be seen in that bunch sprint, and Kristoff won it pretty comfortably. We'll talk about Jack Bauer soon, but Kristoff, quite an impressive winner today.
Yeah, the consensus seems to be about Kittel that he had suffered over the Alps. We talked about this earlier in the race, that although he got all the way through the tour last year, and certainly his team are very confident that he will get through it again this year, he really does suffer probably more than any other sprinter on the climbs. And Kristoff is a guy who, you know, he will tell you that he feels just as tired as everyone else at the end of very long and hard one-day races and also 2 weeks into a major tour. But the sort of decrease in the power that he's able to put out is not quite as significant as it is for other riders. So, you know, he's someone who, relative to the other sprinters, relative to other riders, gets stronger or gets less weak.
He was said at the end that he had some, not sympathy for the two breakaways, Jack Bauer and Martin Almiger, but he would have liked, he said, for Bauer to hold on to second place. Not sure that would have been much consolation.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Well, I just mentioned Kristoff there and how he seems to come good at the end of difficult one-day races and also in major tours. We've got Norway's premier Tour de France correspondent with us, Anders.
Christensen?
Yeah, Christensen. I know what your name is, but I'm just trying to pronounce it right, Anders. So anyway, can you talk to us about Kristoff? Is it a surprise that he's won two stages now in this year's tour?
Well, I would say it's a big surprise he won this one, I think, in the flat sprints, because he's always been talking himself down on the flat sprints when compared to Kittel and Greipel. But if you see his career and the one, it's steady progress all the time. And his coach tells us he's been extreme since he was 14, 15 years old. He has been going on 7 hours trip tours for training tours for so many years. And he has they're talking long term all the time. At stage two in England, the hilly one, yeah. He managed to sit there until 5Ks. And I asked his coach if it must be disappointed. You didn't make it all up the hill. And he said, no way. This is in the long term, this is fantastic, because he has to go on those kamikazes to, you know, progress in a couple of years. Not now. We don't care about now. We think a couple of years ahead. So everything they're doing is thinking ahead in a long perspective.
So he's a bit more than a pure sprinter. What kind of races then should he be targeting in future years?
Well, if you see last year, he was top 10 in both Roubaix, Flanders and San Remo. And this year he won San Remo and he won in Oman and he won in Frankfurt and he won. So he's obviously a good classic rider, and he has a good sprint as well. So, yeah.
What's he like as a person?
Well, I think he's quite open. You know, he talks and he likes to say what he means. Like the other day when their Porsche didn't make the time cut, he was furious and he told the media, and they had to, you know, talk within the team after the stage, really, to settle.
Was he cross with Porsev, or was he cross with the fact that the organisers didn't show any leniency?
Well, he was furious with the team, because he said, why the hell are we driving? Because there's no way we should be sitting in at the front of the peloton and pulling this one. Because obviously that's what made Porsev suffer at the end of the day. He was sick as well.
Is he happy in that team? And it's because obviously there's a big Russian block in that team, and then the rest of the team is a bit of a motley assortment of different nationalities. There are Spaniards, there are Italians, there's Christoph. How does he fit in with the different groups?
Well, I've been asking myself that question lots of times, but he said, as you said, there are a Russian group, and it's a big one, and I think the social part was quite difficult, at least to start with. It's getting better. But he fits in, and I think generally he's very happy being in a team that's has faith in him. He was in BMC. That was no success, and they're regretting that now. John Lelong said that, although he's not there anymore. But he has confidence in Katusha, and that's the most important thing for him. It's a huge success, the combination.
The social aspect is something that we recognise in this podcast. We have a problem with that as well, don't we? But tell me, there's huge support, obviously, from Norway for Norwegian cyclists, and we're always very conscious of them being out in force to support Tor Hushovd, Edvald Boasen Hagen. Christoph seems to have a slightly lower profile. Is that the case back home as well, or are his achievements equally recognised?
I think you're right. But I think that goes also with Tor Hushovd being so enormous. He's huge in Norway, and he still is, even though he's retiring at the end of the season. So I think it's even more to do with Hushovd being big than Christoph being, you know, yeah, the opposite. But I would say that I think this will change, because Tour de France is huge in Norway. He has won San Remo. People know what it is, but, you know, the big audience doesn't. So this will probably change it a bit, I think.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast supported by Jaguar.
Thank you very much, Anders Christensen, there for joining us.
Anders
Christensen for joining us.
I just want to say something about this pronunciation police, right? When you watch the French TV, they make no attempt to pronounce the English names or any other names in anything other than French accented.
Oh, shut up, Lionel. Anyway, let's go. Let's carry on. The other big story of the day was Jack Bauer, Martin Elmiger, who were away out front, the two of them, from the very start of the stage. I think they had a lead at 1.9 minutes. It started to come down when the race hit some first of all crosswinds, and then some bad weather, and there was a bit of pressure put in front of the bunch. There were briefly echelons. It didn't cause too much damage to the race, and the leads began to fall in. But for the last 20 kilometres, they held it at between 45 seconds and a minute, which was an incredible effort by those two, considering how long they'd been out front. And they almost did it. I mean, I think it was the final 20 metres that Bauer was caught. They didn't mess around too much either. He kind of sat on Elmiger a little bit, then jumped, and he almost got it.
I think it was the final 24 metres, actually, Jack
really?
Bauer was caught. Yeah.
Very good.
Sorry, too obvious maybe, or not obvious enough, or not just
another,
not funny.
Another dad joke from Lionel.
I actually spoke to Rob Hales after the finish today. Rob Hales, he's working for the BBC, but he was with the Enduro Racing team when Jack Bauer first kind of came over to Europe from New Zealand, and he joined Enduro Racing. And actually, when he first came to the UK, he stayed with Rob and Vicky Hales in their house in Derbyshire. And Rob said that although he ate like a horse, he actually said he nearly bankrupted them with his food bill that week. He did kind of repay back by jet washing the patio for them, so that was quite nice.
But, anecdote.
Yeah, the point that Rob made was that he genuinely believed that if Jack Bauer had been wearing the the fully enclosed helmet that the Garmin team have got, the one without the vents, and if he'd been wearing aero overshoes, he thinks he would have won. Yeah, and I was saying, come on, surely not. He said, no, because...
He had two jet engines in his jersey pocket as well, then he probably...
You poo-poo this too easily.
I'm sure you're right.
Well, I don't know whether I'm necessarily... it's not my hypothesis,
but... We know the sort of figures that get quoted about wattage, watts that are saved by aerodynamic equipment, etc. So, and you know, it was 100 meters, not even 100 meters, probably 50.
Yeah.
So
20.
Yeah, over the breakaway was over 200 kilometers, wasn't it? So I'm sure, well, in theory, it would have probably given him the stage victory. But then, of course, you know, would the group have calibrated its chase differently? Probably as well.
Well, of course, yeah. But you know, it's interesting.
A recumbent
point.
Bike, he probably would have won by a good few minutes.
Anyway, recumbent bikes aren't allowed, Richard.
Yeah, but anyway. I'll tell you one thing about Jack Barr is he's a very stylish bike rider. He looks great. We see him a lot.
You always mention this. You always talk about this. Him. Yeah, no, about people in general.
Yeah, well, why not? That's one of the reasons why we watch cycling,
I think. It's fine, but the Pedaleur du Chant, right, that has...
hang on. Yeah, now you mention it, Daniel, let's just pause for a moment.
And now, Pedaleur du Chant.
Well, my Pedaleur de Charme today is obviously Jack Bauer. Very stylish. You know, he's one of these guys. We spoke on yesterday's podcast about how visible Geraint Thomas is at the front of the bunch. And Jack Bauer is very similar. You see him a lot. He's quite a big guy. But he's also a very classy-looking, stylish-looking rider. There was that brilliant photograph from the tour when it was in Yorkshire of them riding up through a village. And Jack Bauer is right at the front of the bunch, as he tends to be quite a lot. He's one of these guys who, like Geraint Thomas, seems to do a lot of his work at the front. Very, very classy, very stylish bike rider who also until quite recently, he's 29 now, until quite recently back in New Zealand, he was working as a cycle courier and a gym sort of instructor, a spinning class instructor, I believe.
Yeah, he's got a degree in physical education, I think.
Yeah. Daniel, who's your Pedaleur de Charme?
Pedaleur de Charme was going to be Vincenzo Nibali. He is also someone who looks very good on a bike, but just for that 10-second fragment of action where BMC went to the front and it looked as though the bunch was going to split, the wind started gusting in from the side of the road, and Nibali found himself in a dangerous position, and he's just sprinted up the side of the peloton in the space of sort of 50 metres. He made up about 20 positions. It was very impressive. And also, Pedaleur du Chant to Vincenzo Nibali for the way he's dealing with the doping questions in press conferences. Just, I'm quite impressed by how unruffled he is and how sort of spontaneously he seems to be answering the questions. I mean, it doesn't mean a whole lot, but certainly, you know, if you were a body language expert and you were to contrast Vincenzo Nibali's demeanour with someone like Floyd Landis in 2006, or even people more recent, even Chris Froome last year, you would say that Nibali is a lot cooler in these situations.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
So Lionel, we were in Talard this morning at the stage start. I spoke to Sebastian Piquet, the voice of the Tour de France, and you'll hear the interview with him a little bit later on. But you were a busy bee as well.
Well, yeah, I picked up a couple of little bits of gossip. Dave Brailsford wasn't around at the Skybus, not because he was trying to avoid an inquest into whether they should or shouldn't have had a plan B, C, D, but because he went to visit his father, John Brailsford, who lives not far from there. I don't know whether he's still working as a mountain guide.
But I think he might be still, and he was recently wrote a book about mountaineering in the Alps. Also the inventor of a couple of climbing nuts.
Mm. Nuts. Indeed.
Nuts or nuts?
Nuts.
I thought he was an inventor of a knot.
Nuts. Oh, climbing nuts.
Anyway, so in honour of Richard's rumours, I'm going to start an early one that may well get shot down in flames tomorrow at the Omega Pharma Quickstep press conference that Mark Cavendish is going to be at. But I'm going to put a fictional pound on Mark Cavendish ending his career at Team Sky. Just throw that one out there.
Really?
You're looking at that. Well, that's what I thought, but, you know, I'm just sharing something that I've heard today.
Okay, this all goes well for volume 4 of Mark Cavendish's autobiography.
I can probably guess who told you that, but I'm very, very sceptical.
Well, I was very sceptical, but, you know, that's...
That's the kind of scoop I would have expected from Richard, fully expected from Richard, but coming from you, Lionel, I'm slightly appalled by that. Anyway.
Well, I got a lot of detailed information about this particular idea, but, you know, it's still a long way in the middle distance. I was more interested in it this morning just to get a bit of a steer on what other people think of Romain Bardet and Thibaut Pinot and how the fact that two Frenchmen are fighting for a place on the podium is affecting the race. It's sort of whether it's giving the French a spring in their step. And a couple of people I spoke to were Nico Roach, who rides for Tinkoff Saxo now, but was a teammate of Romain Bardet's AG2R. And he's known Bardet since he was young because Bardet came through the AG2R feeder team. And he, as people often do, but I have no reason to suspect it, he says he spotted Bardet's talent very early. But he also had a few words to say about Thibaut Pinot.
Well, they're actually giving a great battle. I mean, you know, especially for those French fans who have been waiting for kind of GC rider lately. There have been a lot of good sprinters, you know, with Boani and Demar, and they were waiting for this kind of GC revelation to come up over the last, I don't know, almost 15 years now, you know. At some stage, there was big hopes on Chavanel, and he never really made it. Moncoutier the same. They made it in different ways, but never as a proper GC rider. And finally, well, there's not one, but there's three, because, you know, you can't forget Pierre Boulon, who was a fourth or fifth in the Giro rider, and he's been a couple of times in the top 10 already in the Tour. So, you know, they have three top young riders, because, you know, like Roland's 28, but the other two are about 25, aren't they? So I've been following more closely Bardet, because we were together at AG Tour, but even before he passed pro, he was in the pre-AG Tour team with the under-23s and the formation. And, you know, he was brought up with AG Tour. Every training camp, they always send him and two or three other riders. And, you know, I always saw him as a big talent, and we always have a good contact. But it's, you know, being a big talent and being a big hope is one thing, and making it into the top ranks of the Tour de France is another big thing. You know, there's many young riders who you can put, you know, you can say, oh, they're going to be good, but they never make it. But Bardet is really, really making it. You know, he's I'm impressed. At the beginning of the Tour, I said, you hold on in there, you'd be around fifth or seventh. Obviously, I thought that was already a superb performance, but he's actually fighting for the podium now, so congrats.
You came through the French club system as well. Has anything changed in the last 4 or 5 years that means that these riders, because it's not just the climbers, is it? There's a couple of French sprinters who are capable of winning as well.
They've definitely, if I can say, picked up all the ideas from with the much bigger structures. You know, I mean, I saw anyway with AG Tour in the last 2 years that I was there that, you know, that they were pushing really with their own budget, because, you know, they're not in limited 20 million euro team. So, you know, when you have the budget, you also need to be careful of how you spend your money. But, you know, they're already pushing for the wind tunnels and, you know, I mean, something that sounds stupid, but essential, you know, TT bikes at home. I remember my first, I had to wait 5 years pro to have a TT bike at home. And then eventually, you know, now all these are the things are getting in place, and, you know, obviously a lot more staff structure, and, you know, they're, like I said, they're kind of copying the bigger structures, but they're doing it in the right way. And, you know, it took them a while to forget the Eno days and to move forward, but I think, you know, and also, I mean, it'd be too easy if every generation have a superstar.
So if you had to just sum up their strengths and weaknesses against one another, who's better at what out of Bardet and Pinot?
I would favour Bardet. I think Pinot is a great pure climber, and he's exciting to watch. He's not afraid to attack. But I think Bardet is a much more complete rider. Even though I have to say I've been super surprised yesterday when that Bardet attacked on the descent. Pinot was still there in the group when he's renowned to be a horrible descender. So I actually gave him a tap on the back yesterday when he went past me, because, and, you know, he understood, because a few times I've been trying to push him. You know, I have a good relation with both riders. And I was happy to see him there. I think they're giving a great show, and, you know, the Grand Tour, but also for, like I said, more even for the French fans.
Well, I also spoke to Alan Piper, the director sportif of the BMC racing team, really because he was one of the Anglophone riders who went to the Parisian club in the late 70s, early 80s, the ACBB, that's the Athletic Club de Boulogne-Billancourt on the outskirts of Paris. And they had a real love affair with English-speaking riders at that time. Stephen Roach, Nicholas's dad, was one of the riders who went through that club and then turned professional. And I just wanted to find out from Alan what he thought of Romain Bardet and Thibaut Pinot.
Actually, it's not just those two riders. There's a whole young peloton coming out of France that's sort of a real breath of fresh air, you know. And they've got sprinters, which they haven't had in recent memory, that can win races. They've got guys up there in the top 10 looking at podiuming in the Tour de France, which has been a really long time as well. And I think that sort of goes back to the development and forward thinking of the French Federation, maybe.
What do you think of Bardet and Pinot when you sort of stack them up against each other?
Well, Pinot's more explosive on the climbs, of course. You know, apparently, from all reports, he's not the greatest descender. He doesn't have a great time trial and will concede some time there. Bardet's a lot younger, climbs very well, he's good on his bike. I don't really know how to rate him as a time trialist in a Grand Tour for 3 weeks because he hasn't really been tested on that terrain, but seems like a nice kid and a real fighter as well. So, you know, I think those two guys, you know, coming in are great for the sport because the French have got something to get behind for once.
Do you think that if one of them perhaps makes the podium, or perhaps both of them make the podium, I don't know how you see that, but that's going to put a real weight of expectation on both their relatively young shoulders?
That's what sport's all about. You know, if you're shooting for the top and you end up podiuming the Tour de France, that comes with the terrain, doesn't it? And probably more so if you're French, but, you know, if you're Belgian, it's the same thing. If you're good at the classics, maybe it's less for Australians and Americans, but, you know, that does come with the terrain, and I'm sure that their management teams will be able to protect them somewhat, you know, from the press. But, you know, I think the main thing is them keeping their feet on the ground and focusing on what they've got to do, and then that keeps the expectation at bay anyway.
If you had to pick one of them to finish on the podium over the other, who's looking like the favourite out of the two of them at the moment?
I might say Pinot. You know, it's a long shot at a week out, but I might say Pinot just because of his explosivity on the climbs. And it looked like a couple of times in the last 2 days that Bardet was cracking a little bit on the final climb. We've got three big Pyrenees stages coming up. You know, he's still the younger of the whole group, and a whole career ahead of him. And, you know, I maybe give the forward position to Pinot at this point.
Daniel, we've just seen Romain Bardet's sister, Lisa,
star of the podcast,
leaving the press room.
I was about to say, Lionel, she assured me earlier today that Romain will be listening to the podcast tomorrow.
Really?
He'll be listening to her interview, which was on yesterday's podcast, wasn't it? She will go and see him in the team hotel and and force him to listen to the podcast.
Right, hi Romain, if you're listening.
Yeah, so if he falls away from his high overall placing down into the mid-teens in the Pyrenees, then we know exactly who to blame.
He's very much looking forward to the Pyrenees, I think. I think we mentioned this a few days ago, that he thinks the Pyrenees will suit him better. Pinot has said that he prefers the Alps. He likes the sort of consistent gradients that you tend to find more in the Alps, certainly on this year's Tour de France route. So it'd be interesting to see how they both fare. I should probably stop talking about this because I drone on about it every day. So over to Richard.
I quite like it, Daniel. We're near the drone area of France, are we not at the moment?
The drome, Richard. Complete buffoon.
Still a week to go, chaps. Come on, let's keep it civil.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib.
Anyway, Richard, yes. You had a very interesting chat with a man who people back at home probably have no idea who he is or what his job is, but it's Sebastian, the voice of race radio. And I've travelled in team cars at ASO events and been incredibly impressed by this upper-class English-accented French coming across.
That sounded like you was coming say something really insulting there.
No, not at all. He reads out the numbers in perfect French and then reads out the numbers and gives the information in perfect English. And of course, his job is basically travelling in one of the cars, which immediately follows the bunch, doesn't it?
That's correct. Yes, we had a chat in the village this morning, Sebastian Piquet. He speaks perfect English. He actually spent 10 years of his childhood in London, attending the French school in South Kensington, and he does speak very, very good English indeed, and a very distinctive voice. People will also maybe recognise him from the opening ceremony to this year's tour, which he co-hosted with Jill Douglas.
In a Paul Smith suit?
In a Paul Smith suit with a very natty waistcoat.
Quite a nice story, wasn't it? I think he met Paul Smith a few months ago. I can't remember why or where, but he'd got the gig to present the opening ceremony, and he was wondering what he could wear, and he thought, right, I'll contact Paul Smith, I'll send him an email. Didn't expect to hear back, and Paul Smith said, yep, sure, come in.
He asked if he could borrow a suit for the event, and Paul Smith got back to him and said, just go into our store in Leeds and pick a suit.
So they were waiting for him, weren't they? And they gave him the freedom of the shop for an afternoon.
Yeah.
He came out with a very natty waistcoat. I advised him not to wear the waistcoat, but he did.
I actually went in and told them that my name was Sebastian Piquet and I was in to collect my free suit. And it didn't work, unfortunately. But anyway, I sat down with him. When you are, you know, he is the voice of the tour in the inner sanctum of the tour. Daniel Monjas is the public voice of the tour. Sebastian Piquet is the voice of the tour on Race Radio Tour, which communicates with all the directeurs sportifs, some of the media. The TV commentary relies entirely on the information they're getting from this man. So it's a very interesting, very stressful job with a lot of responsibility. You know, when we're not driving, Lionel, we can nod off, we can have 40 winks. He can't do that. He can't close his eyes for a second in case something happens. And it's been a very dramatic tour, obviously, this year. So I sat down with him and we chatted a bit about his job. So Sebastian, the voice of the race, how's the voice holding up?
The voice is still there for the moment, and I still have a week. We still have a week to go, but the voice is fine. Although I've had to cope with the heat and the rain and the heat and the rain, but it's all right. Everything
takes its toll on you as well as the riders, eh?
Yeah, it's been honestly, it's been a very demanding Tour de France ever since the start in Leeds. I don't think we had one stage without a major event, either a crash or an eventful race or attacks or mountains. It's been so far a fantastic race, and we've had things happening every single day, so that's good.
So, I mean, you are the voice of Race Radio in English and French.
Oui.
Can you talk us through your day?
I'm in a car, in the race direction car, just behind the pack. So I can only talk about what I see, first of all. So what do I see behind the pack? Riders being dropped, punctures, crashes. Riders calling their team director's car for punctures because they're thirsty. And then to know what goes on at the front of the race, I have three motorbikes, Moto Info, and they basically are my eyes on the front of the race. And they tell me what goes on in the breakaways, who are the riders in the breakaway, what the gaps are. And they're obviously a whole part of the concept of the way things work. And then being behind the pack in the mountains, we overtake the drop riders and we end up being really at the heart of the action, behind the yellow jersey group, behind all the favorites. And it's more of a journalist's work to explain what goes on, who's attacking, who's riding up front, who is being dropped, because basically they're just 5 meters in front of me, so it's a very privileged position to be right behind all the favourites.
Well, an awful lot of pressure as well to get the information right.
Yeah, a lot of pressure. I can't get the information wrong because it has a direct effect on the team director's cars, on journalists who are commentating. If I say something wrong, being the official voice of Radio Tour, it can have an effect. I remember a couple of years ago, a sprint stage, and there'd been a crash in the final kilometer, and someone in the car said, "Oh, Cavendish crashed," and I immediately said on Radio Tour, Mark Cavendish crashes and he actually went on to win the stage. So that's something I can only trust myself. And it has a direct effect on journalists who are commentating or on Jagtar spotters who are just behind.
In terms of it, when you're in the car following the bunch and you're seeing riders stick their hands up, come back, be involved in a crash, do you have any help in identifying the riders, I mean, in the car, or are you just sort of referring all the time to your start sheet?
Well, yeah, I have my start sheet, and I mean, when I see a hand in the air, I first of all call the team. That's not very difficult. We have 22 teams, so I mean, I know the 22 teams and what the jerseys look like, and then you see the numbers. And you also see. I know the riders, so I basically can say identify if it's Contador or Froome or different riders. But basically, I really have to remain focused all day from kilometer zero to the final kilometer to the finish line. I can't sleep. Although I can tell you, these last few days, I've my eyes sometimes closed, but I really have to remain focused because a crash can happen at any moment. A puncture can occur, so I really have to remain very, very focused.
How do you get into this job? How do you become race radio?
At the time, I was working for ASO on another event they own called the Dakar Rally. And I was working in French and English, and I received a phone call from the Tour de France while I was on the Dakar, and they said, listen, John Lelangue, who was doing Radio Tour before me, has resigned from ASO because he's going to take care of a team. Would you mind trying to do Radio Tour in Qatar? So my first experience of Radio Tour was in Qatar, and I've been in race car number 2 ever since.
Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you a cycling fan anyway?
Yeah, I'm a big cycling fan. I mean, you have to be a big cycling fan. And I really, even today, even after 10 years on the Tour de France, when I find myself going up whatever final climb just behind the yellow jersey group with all the favourites in front of me, I said, I really am lucky to be in this position.
Presumably you're not allowed to swear on race radio either, are you?
No, I don't. And I have to watch out, really watch out what I say, because I work with a pedal, and I press the pedal with my foot, and I speak in a microphone, and sometimes I press the pedal without noticing, and I talk about various other things. The other day I talked about my sandwich, and that went on air on Radio Tour. So,
what's been the most stressful or dramatic moment of this tour?
I guess the most stressful moments are the crashes, because they happen just like that, and you have to have your eyes everywhere, try to notice the riders who are in the crash. So I guess that's the most stressful moment. But
do you tend to linger behind the crash, or are you straight past it?
No, we go past it.
Yeah.
We go past it, so I have to be very, very quick at looking at the riders, giving the numbers, or if it's a favourite, talking about Froome or things like that, because we immediately overtake the crash and go behind the pack.
We heard during the Giro how important it is that the information conveyed over race radio is accurate and reliable, and there was an issue there about whether descent was neutralised or not, which is quite an unheard of, unprecedented sort of thing to happen in the middle of a road race. You don't want to maybe talk about a colleague too much, but do you know what happened there?
I honestly don't know what happened there. What I know is that the person doing race radio on the Giro is, I believe, in a car at the front of the race. He is not in contact directly with the people from the UCI or with Race Action. In our car, we are behind the pack. In the car, I have Thierry Gouvenou, who is the race director, and I have Ingo Ries, who is the president of the Commissaires. So all decisions that are taken in the car are taken with Thierry Gouvenou and with Ingo. So if they say something, they ask me to say something on Radio Tour, they've discussed it together. Race organization and UCI, and there can't be a problem there. On the Giro, I believe it's not the same way of thinking, the same way of working.
What's the hierarchy there in terms of race director, ASO, and chief commissar, UCI? Are they very much in tandem, so to speak?
No, they really are in tandem. They discuss during the whole day on whether to have a neutral car behind this group. They discuss as much as possible. They work hand in hand together.
I mean, this
there's no hierarchy.
And imagine that you said that you're on from the beginning to the end of the stage. These stages can last 4 to 6 to 7 hours. You must be pretty drained at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. It's pretty tiring because, again, you can't close your eyes and have a quick nap. You have to remain focused all the time because, again, anything can happen. The other thing is you have to have a solid stomach and not be sick in a car because that was one of my worries when I started doing it, because going down the Pyrenees and the Alps, the big mountains, it's the drivers are driving at over 100 kilometers an hour, so you have to be...
And dare I ask, how do you stop for a natural break?
We stop once, and if the stage is over 200 kilometers long, we stop twice.
So you have to be or we have
an empty bottle just in case.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Okay, so that was Sebastian Piquet. We should remind you that you can subscribe to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, on iTunes. Also find us on Twitter at @cycling_podcast, on Facebook. If you like us, you can win a pair of Oakleys. There is a pair of Oakleys to be won, honestly. And website is thecyclingpodcast.com. I'm doing a blog at the moment on Sebastian Piquet and his job as the voice of the tour. So that should be up very soon. Daniel, anything to add about the next few days? We've got a rest day tomorrow in Carcassonne, a lot of press conferences to attend, including Omega Pharma Quickstep, which, as you mentioned, Lionel Mark Cavendish will be at, apparently. But the Pyrenees then loom in the near distance, and what can we expect there, mountain man?
I mean, three really nasty stages, starting with the stage finishing in Luchon, with the Porte de Balaise climb in the final. This has become a bit of a classic on the tour. We saw it in 2012 with a very fast descent into Luchon. And, of course, hipsters will remember that Anthony Charteau in the 2011 Route du Sud completely lost his marbles on the Porte de Balaise descent. So I think it's a dangerous one for Thibaut Pinot.
Porte de Balaise was also chain gate, was it not?
Yes, it was. It was.
With Andy Schleck.
Apparently,
hipster is no longer an acceptable term. If you use hipster, you're by definition not a hipster.
Okay, well, I can live with that. Then the second day in the Pyrenees, another absolute rotter, finishing at Pla d'Adet, which will forever be associated with Raymond Poulidor dropping Eddie Merckx in 1972.
And George Hincapie's never quite finished resort in Carolina somewhere.
George Hincapie nominally won there in 2005, but who actually inherited that stage win? Anyone know?
Yes, it was a Spanish rider, Oscar Pereira.
Yeah, he was very good at inheriting titles from Americans who failed dope tests. It was his speciality.
It was that victory that prompted George Hincapie to stop doping, was it not? He realised it was getting ridiculous.
Possibly a moot point. So that is a toughie, and then the next day the finishes at Horsecam, another summit finish, comes after the Tourmalet.
Will anyone ride up there in a big ring this year, do you think, like Bjarne Riis did in 96?
Unlikely. Bjarne Riis, whose name has been crossed out of, there's a banner at the top of Horsecam which lists all of the winners there in the Tour de France. His name has gone. Leonardo Piepoli, who won the stage but was subsequently disqualified in 2008. His name is gone. Luc Leblanc is still up there. Luc Leblanc, who I mentioned on Twitter the other day, looking very beleaguered. This is the 1994 World Road Race Championship, a bit of a cult figure. He now works for RMC Radio on the tour. But the other day I came out of the press room, where was that? That was Saint-Étienne. And was just leaving on the way back to my hotel, saw Luc Leblanc at the side of the road, his car was written off about 10 metres away.
Oh, that was who we saw coming out, yeah, down the little back street, and it crashed into a member of the public.
He'd driven straight into a civilian car.
That was not his version of events, but had a brief chat with him, he was okay, but his car obviously wasn't. So he won at Horsecam in you remember when that was? 94, 92?
I think it might be 94.
Okay. Well, anyway, his name is still on the banner.
Relatively new climb to the Tour, really, Hortecam, isn't it? Only 20-odd years?
Yeah, only appeared for the first time in the... I think LeBlanc was the first man to win there. Quite a typical Pyrenean climb, quite irregular. Some flat sections, some steep sections. Pino, I went on a recce with Pino there in May, and he quite liked it. It's one of the climbs that he thinks he can make time on. So, we thought that the Tour would be won or lost in the Pyrenees. I think that's unlikely to happen now with Nibali winning so emphatically, but certainly I think a lot will happen in the minor positions in the top 10.
The other Hortecam stage you haven't mentioned was back in the early 2000s, I've forgotten which year, but one of the Armstrong tours where the Spanish rider
Ochoa. Javier Ochoa.
Yeah.
Javier or Ricardo.
Well, they were twin brothers, weren't they? Brothers. Who had terrible accident.
Yeah.
Which I can't.
Yeah, I think Ricardo ended up training for, if not competing in the Paralympics
in Athens, I think. We'll look. I've written about this actually. We'll look into this. We've got a few days before Hortecam, and there is an amazing story. I remember that day there was Armstrong, but also Pantani and others, and it was an awful weather as well. Let's revisit Hortecam before the tour actually visits there, and let's leave it there as we prepared to travel to Carcassonne for the rest day and the press conferences, and we will report back on Tuesday when the race resumes. We will be doing another Velo News cycling podcast
this time,
supported by Jaguar.
Am I invited this time?
Featuring Daniel Fried.
Really?
Well, yeah. Daniel, there's an open invitation.
Where are you staying?
Out by the airport in Carcassonne.
Oh, same here. Airport, hotel, Ibis, budget.
Yeah, same here.
Oh,
we're all in the same place.
You know, has it got washing machines?
I've no idea.
No. Well, but I do know where the laundrette is in Carcassonne.
Wonderful.
Right, great.
Turning his nose up at even visiting a laundrette, I find extraordinary.
Maybe you can take our washing for us, Lionel, if you're going. Anyway.
I'm not doing that for you ever again, Richard. You just weren't grateful last time.
Anyway, let's leave it there, and we'll head over to Carcassonne, and we'll be back with the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, on Tuesday. Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you both.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.